Millions of people are living better. They are enjoying a healthier lifestyle, learning more about overcoming obstacles and keeping a positive outlook. Now you can be a member of the club. This is the Living to 100 Club with Dr. Joe Casciani. Our guests share incredible stories and advice, bring new outlooks on wellness, and show you how to keep moving forward. Now, here is your host, Dr. Joe Casciani.
Well, good day to everyone joining us on the Voice America Network. Thank you and welcome. I'm your host, Joe Casciani, and you're listening to the Living to 100 Club radio show. I'd like to take just a minute before we get started to thank everyone who tune into our show. This is our 20th episode, and since starting in June, we've had nearly 10,000 listeners in the U.S. and other countries. Between the live episodes and those listening afterward to the recordings. So, thanks to everyone for your support. We have an exciting show today. We'll be talking about the ability or capacity to make decisions and how advancing age may interfere with this capacity. As you may know, Living to 100 brings with it new challenges and hurdles. And the goal of our Living to 100 Club is to keep moving forward as best we can, no matter what gets in the way. And sometimes we have to make important decisions, financial decisions like selling our home, or medical decisions like having the surgery that our doctor recommends. But will our mental ability stay sharp enough to make sound decisions? And how do we know when we lose this capacity or when our spouse or parent loses this capacity? Our guest today will help us answer these questions. Dr. Peter Lichtenberg, PhD, is the director of the Institute of Gerontology and a professor of psychology at Wayne State University, a clinician and researcher throughout his career. Dr. Lichtenberg has made contributions to the practice of psychology across a variety of areas, including Alzheimer's disease, medical rehabilitation, and those suffering from late-life depression. He's particularly interested in the areas of intersection between financial capacity and financial exploitation, finding ways to balance autonomy and protection for older adults. He was a contributor to a handbook for a psychologist titled Assessment of Diminished Capacity of Older Adults, published jointly by the American Bar Association and the American Psychological Association. He has published the Lichtenberg Financial Decision-Making Rating Scales, tools that can be used to assess major financial decisions and or transactions of older adults. He's authored over 7 books and over 180 scientific articles in gerontology. Peter, thank you for joining us today on our show.
I'm delighted to be here. Thank you so much, Joe, for inviting me.
Yeah, you're very welcome. Well, let's start with your background. You're the director of the Institute of Gerontology at Wayne State University. Tell us about the Institute. What does it do?
Yeah, the Institute is quite unique. It was founded the same year of the Older Americans Act, 1965. It was founded by the state of Michigan. And it 20 years later got rolled into Wayne State University properly. We're a research institute, so we do mostly social and behavioral science research as well as cognitive neuroscience research, mostly on issues of aging and health, demography and aging, service provision and aging, health services. But we also do quite a bit of community outreach and engagement. We educate over 10,000 older adults a year and professionals. And we also have a training program for the next generation of aging researchers. Our institute has faculty from medical anthropologists to cognitive neuroscientists, so we cover a broad area.
Wow, that's great. You got to feel good about all those accomplishments. Yeah, so what got you started working with older adults? You've spent your career with this age group.
My mother remembers that when I was 16, I told her, I'm going to work with older adults and I'm going to become a psychologist. And I think it was directly related to my wonderful relationship with both my grandparents, both sides, and my great aunts and uncles. So I had a lot of great role models about aging And I kind of fell in love with that generation. And the more I got into it, the more I enjoyed it.
So you currently work in research. I know you do teaching. You have clinical practice as well. Tell us about your current professional work.
Yeah, I probably split my time about 30% administration, just keeping those institutes running and fundraising and personnel things, about 30% clinical research. My research is really all in how do I improve clinical practice and improve the lives of older adults. I would say 15% mentoring, 10% either course lectures or community lectures, 5% on kind of community task forces and panels and so forth, and probably about 10% I do expert work in the probate system for issues of capacity or undue influence.
So you apply all the research that you come up with and the institute comes up with. Yeah,
you know, so, from my expert work, I really get some of the research questions.
So what changes have you seen over the years in terms of psychological services with older adults?
You know, it's been a bumpy ride up and down, I think, because in terms of healthcare services for older adults, back in the mid-1980s when I got my degree was when there were specialty units in healthcare systems, and those continued for about a decade, and then they slowly often have been replaced by just more general units. I think many healthcare systems, even though it was advantageous to the older adult, it was a little too expensive, or they felt that it was. And so it's come around now to more services in the community, I think, that are really trying to help older adults remain healthy and in their homes and improve their well-being. One of the great things about psychology has been just the explosion of wonderful research and tools and methods to help older adults with health and mental health problems through psychological principles.
Yeah, I agree. I've seen a lot of that myself in my own clinical work. How about the actual practitioners? Are you seeing more people coming into this specialty area, or is it kind of leveled off?
You know, in the medical field, we see many, many fewer because, as I said, the programs got cut and the appeal is just not there. So while we have an aging population, one reason we do so much continuing education ourselves as an institute is because we've lost that specialty workforce. And so really the general workforce needs to be infused with understanding issues around aging and aging health. I think that there is a small cadre of experts in geropsychology who really have a tremendous amount of knowledge, and I'm always impressed by the level of expertise that colleagues in our field are coming out with now.
Sure. And we see it in all licenses, all specialty, in terms of LCSWs and master's level individuals, PhDs, physicians, nurse practitioners, so a lot of different specialties actually coming into this field. Yeah, so you've studied decision-making capacity. I know I'm familiar with your work. You've just tell us, what is this area and what are we talking about when you're looking at decision-making capacity?
I'll tell you a little bit of a funny story about how I even got into it, Joe. My colleague Debbie Strezpeck and I at Western State Hospital helped found the co-ed Alzheimer's unit, and it never occurred to us that there might be some romantic relationships that would spring up. And instead of just outlawing them, we came up with an approach, a guided interview approach to assessing capacity for participation in intimate relationships. And that really got me interested in decision-making capacity and when working for a group that you and I belonged to for a long time, psychologists in long-term care, I was invited by the VA to be help establish some practice guidelines for psychologists. Well, that expertise, before I knew it, I was starting to get some calls from attorneys asking me, hey, I've got an older adult who wants to change their will or enter a contract or create a trust, and I'm not sure they're capable of doing it. Could you do an assessment? And they turned to me because I do a lot of and did a lot of straight dementia assessments and assessing cognitive abilities and whether people still had intact cognition or whether they were having problems with memory or problem solving and so forth. And I was fortunate enough to be hired by an attorney that kind of took me under his wing and taught me how to be an expert. As he said to me, you don't know anything about this, that's why I want you, because you know a lot about dementia. And he taught me how to be an expert. And after that, I really started to get very interested in helping individuals. Oftentimes, when an older adult is in a situation, their autonomy is at stake. Somebody has filed to become their guardian or conservator, or the older adult wants to change a will or trust. And these are big decisions. These are big, momentous things. And it's important to balance, as you said in your introductory remarks, when do we support autonomy and when do we need to provide protection? Because I'll call it the dark side of financial capacity or decision-making capacity is financial exploitation.
Sure, sure. So even at the basic example that you started with, making decisions to have a relationship with another person, that decision in itself can be vulnerable to exploitation or being taken advantage of. So does that still come into the picture of the work that you do?
Absolutely. And you're 100% correct. That was one of the things. At all costs, we need to avoid exploitation. And even among married couples, exploitation in a long-term care facility needs to be avoided. So that was a big part of our interview process and assessment. And we see this in financial decision-making. You see undue influence or coercion where somebody really is, through means of isolation and poisoning the older adult's relationship with other folks, taking control and substituting their own desires for the older adult. We see a lot of abuse of trust, and that goes across just about any profession or even in families. And we see, unfortunately, financial entitlement where adult children feel almost like the older adult has outlived what they expected them to, so now it's time to take their inheritance early, and they feel entitled to do that as an older adult becomes a little bit more frail.
Yeah, so I'm just wondering, there are times when decisions might be questionable, but not because of dementia, but just for other reasons, personality style or changes in outlook, or a person becomes more eccentric. I know we're going to be talking more about decision-making ability and how to measure that, but how about those cases where dementia is not even part of the picture and the person changes and wants to, like, change the will, as you mentioned?
Yeah, so we're not saying that people shouldn't be able to make bad decisions or poor decisions. everybody has the right to make their own decisions, provided that they can meet the elements of informed decision making. And, you know, things change quite a bit. Relationship strain over finances actually can change within families, and older adults can feel pressured by their adult children and decide to make some changes in the way that they want their will to be administered. personalities do change sometimes, and you know, kind of what we value most changes. That's our right to do as a human being, and it's important to, you know, protect that autonomy. It really is, and I can give you an example of a case that was a romance inheritance scam where the person didn't have dementia, but they had executive functioning deficits that really got them in serious trouble. And they really didn't have the decision-making capacity. It had really been unduly influenced, and the scammers basically had taken over control. There was an individual, fairly wealthy individual, who was, you know, sort of recruited by phone into a couple of different relationships. And the idea was that if he married one of these women who they themselves were supposed to inherit money, but in their culture they couldn't unless they were married. So two things, you know, one, the companionship, and two, he's going to win another fortune. And before his family knew it, he had sent about $800,000 to a scammer. And when I was brought in on the case, he just didn't have the understanding or appreciation. He still totally believed, even in the face of being told by the FBI and by others that this was a fraud and a scam, he didn't have the appreciation and understanding that this wasn't real. These individuals weren't even real. It was just all, you know, kind of a make-believe way of scamming him. And sure, his concrete thinking, and just combined with some of the social isolation he had experienced, it really got him stuck there. So wow, that's an example where there was no dementia, but he also didn't meet the standards for informed decision making.
Sure, sure. The executive functions were deficient. Yeah, and limited judgment. Well, we'll be getting back to the, you know, assessment of decision making. It's time to take a short break right now. For those who are listening, please call in your questions to 866-472-5792. Or send an email to info@living200club. This is Joe Casciani, and my guest is Dr. Peter Lichtenberg. You're listening to the Living 200 Club on the Voice America Health and Wellness Channel. Stay tuned. We'll be right back.
Your life, your health, your network. You're listening to Voice America Health and Wellness.
Visit the Living to 100 Club to experience the creative spirit, inspiration, and wellness information that you're looking for to maintain a healthy lifestyle, promote mental and physical fitness, and allow you to take control of your future. You'll find links to leading aging organizations and see our series of blogs. Get details about our weekly radio show and schedule of upcoming guests. Sign up to be a club member to receive newsletters and radio announcements and a copy of our member handbook, or opt for an annual premium membership with special access to our secure member forum and opportunities to ask the experts, plus transcripts of show recordings and other members-only offers. Visit the Living to 100 Club website for awareness, insights, and independence. Find us at livingto100.club. That's livingto100.club.
Are you living a healthy and fit lifestyle? It's not just related to your physical well-being. It also means a healthier mind, confidence, improved health, stamina, and fitness. Talking with Tremaine brings it all to you. Host Tremaine Ellis, along with her husband and co-host David Ellis, will offer support, advice, guidance, and motivation to keep you in your best shape, both physically and mentally. Talking with Tremaine can be heard live every Wednesday at 6 p.m. Eastern Time and 3 Pacific on the Voice America Health and Wellness Channel.
Have you become a member yet? Sign up now to become a member of Voice America. It's always free and easy. Plus, you get to take advantage of some great member benefits. Get unlimited access to millions of hours of on-demand content across all of our channels. Keep track of your favorite episodes, shows, and hosts in your own customizable library. Find out what shows you might be interested in based on your favorites. Plus, you get insider access with our newsletter. Membership gives you more. Sign up at voiceamerica.com and click register at the top right.
Real Life Solutions. Voice America Health and Wellness.
You are listening to the Living to 100 Club with Dr. Joe Casciani. To reach the program today, please call in to 1-866-472-5792. That's 1-866-472-5792. You may also send an email to info@livingto100.club. Now, back to this week's show.
All right, we're back. Thanks to everyone for staying with us. We're talking today with Dr. Peter Lichtenberg about decision-making capacity. Peter, just before the break, we were looking at how do we measure a person's ability to make decisions. So let's jump into that area. What do you look at? What kind of functions, what kind of cognitive functions do you look at?
Thank you, Joe. You know, really when I do a capacity assessment to measure decision making, it's really a five-step process. And the first step is to really look at their neurocognitive and mental health functioning. And so in studying cognition, assessing cognition, we'll assess from the five areas of attention and language, memory, visual, spatial, kind of nonverbal problem solving, as well as executive functioning or more complicated problem solving. The second step, which really I saw that there was a hole in this, was to measure this decisional abilities, the underlying decision-making for a specific decision. And, you know, informed decisions really are defined by the legal standards pretty much as having four elements. Can an older adult communicate the choice that they want to make? Can they communicate an understanding of that choice? An appreciation of that choice, of how it will, what the potential consequences of it, what are the potential risks and benefits, how might it affect somebody else. I always use the example when I'm speaking at a nonprofit, I say, well, I could decide to give all my money to this nonprofit, and that would be great if I also realized that that meant that my children were not going to receive any inheritance. And a lot of times in cognitive impairment, we'll see that somebody is giving money without a realization that that impacts, that appreciation of how it impacts somebody else. And then the fourth part is the rationale or reasoning, especially when there's cases where dementia is involved, there can be quite a psychotic or paranoid delusion that's kind of impacting their decision-making. This can happen with serious mental illness as well. The third step really is to look at how people, how aware are they of their deficits, of their challenges, because people will tend to, if they are aware, they will tend to try to compensate for those. And many times they can overcome those challenges through compensation. But what we know about many cases of serious mental illness or dementia is that the lack of awareness can be a hallmark symptom. And so people aren't going to compensate because they don't really think anything's wrong. The fourth thing is that most always we need to look at undue influence and whether this is somebody's autonomous, authentic choice or whether it really represents somebody else's desire and it's not their own free will. And then we, in the fifth step, take the actual legal standards, and they do differ between states a bit, so you have to look at each state legal standards and apply the findings of the assessment. So my assessments usually will take anywhere from 3 to 4 hours. of face-to-face interviews, testing, and then it's another couple of hours to really score up the results, integrate them with the legal findings, and produce a report.
Mm. So, yeah, a lot of questions here, but the fifth step, the legal standards, like just for example, what are they in Michigan? What do you need to consider?
Creating a will. You need to know what a will is. You need to have the ability to know what the value of your estate is generally, who your natural heirs are, and have a plan for how you want to distribute the money. And you have to have an understanding and appreciate the nature and effect of your plan. So it gets to that informed decision-making underlying that. Mm-hmm. Guardianship laws are really solely about informed decision-making in Michigan. It's can you take information and understand it, process it, communicate about it in a way that reflects an informed decision.
Mm-hmm. So it's really you're getting answers from your other areas, the other four areas, and seeing how well do they fit or how do they apply to this legal standards, whatever the question is.
That's right. And even though psychologists are not attorneys, obviously, but it really is important to tie psychological assessment into the legal standards when you're in the legal system, such as probate, and you're being asked about somebody's capacity. Mm-hmm. I've read a number of cases where appeals courts have ruled, and in each of those cases, they point out whether or not the expert psychologist was correct in the legal standards that they applied. And what I've seen, Joe, too often is psychologists who are not really trained in how to be a good expert will conduct more or less a clinical evaluation. Notice that the person has some cognitive challenges, maybe even a mild dementia, and just simply extrapolate from that because they have this problem, they need a guardian and a conservator. And I see this over and over again. And I've gotten so frustrated by it that actually a colleague of mine, Ben Mast, and I created an online CE course for psychologists to try to improve the number of people out there and encourage expert geropsychologists to get involved in the probate system and really do a better job with working with older adults.
Mm-hmm. To not draw the inferences just from the cognitive functioning, but to look at the bigger picture. Is that what you're suggesting?
Absolutely. Yeah. And for example, I did an assessment for a conservatorship case, which is to take over somebody's finances. And this individual had memory problems significant enough to say they had mild cognitive impairment, maybe even on the border of mild dementia, but he already had a power of attorney that he trusted in place. He also was very meticulous. He had a lockbox where he kept his checkbook and he put his bills and they paid them together every week. There was no indication that he was in any way, shape, or form losing his money, wasting or dissipating it, as they say in legal standards here. And there was no reason for him to lose his autonomy. As a matter of fact, his brother had already stolen some money from him. And mm-hmm. his brother was the one who wanted to become his conservator. And so sometimes we have to be very careful about overprotection.
Mm-hmm. Sure. So just let me recap then the five areas, the cognitive or neurocognitive functioning, general cognitive attention, language, memory, visual, spatial, executive functioning. Let me ask about that one. It's not black or white, I'm sure. There's probably different levels of impairment. So would one mitigate, like if there are deficits in cognitive function, could they make up for it in some of the other areas that you assess? Or is there just a general rule out?
Well, it's sort of trying to get the picture of, does this person have a neurocognitive disorder? So in order to have a diagnosis of dementia, you have to have impairments in two or more domains that interfere with your daily functioning. And one of the earliest things that dementia interferes with is financial management and financial skills, as well as driving or medication management. So we're kind of getting in our interview a lot of information about how the person functions in their environment. I often do these assessments in an older person's home, so I'll have them give me a tour, and I get a chance to look around and see how things are organized. They have them show me their medications and how they dispense them, if they do it themselves, and so forth. I'll often have them show me their checkbook, and I love to see the check register because you see all the cross outs or getting numbers that don't quite add up and changes that you see from a neat, meticulous one the year before to one where only some of the numbers are written in, there's never a balance and lots of cross outs and so forth.
Yeah, I'm also thinking about individuals who don't have dementia, but maybe they've had a stroke, and instead of a global kind of decline that you see with dementia, maybe there's just some impairments in language or self-expression.
It's so important to assess that, and too often people skip that step. I always assess language comprehension pretty early on, as well as word-finding difficulties. Mm-hmm. And I have had cases where people have had a stroke, been fairly nonverbal because of the stroke, and cognitively quite intact. Mm-hmm. And yet somebody was trying to become their guardian.
Yeah.
Even though they didn't need it.
Yeah. Yeah, I can see that. So it's not always a global decline. It can be uneven, and they may have some other functions that compensate for their losses.
Yeah. That's right. And so important to kind of, you know, I feel that diagnosis is so under appreciated in terms of capacity assessment. Mm-hmm. It tells you a whole lot, and you're pointing out exactly right, is this is a discrete impairment due to a stroke versus a more global impairment due to a progressive dementia.
Mm-hmm. So a lot of it has to do with the actual decisions. Or can they communicate, as you said, can they communicate the understanding of their choice? What does it mean to them? Can they appreciate the risk and benefits? And can they offer a sound rationale or reasoning, where sometimes that severe mental illness will get in the picture? Yeah.
Right. And so what I discovered, Joe, is there were no instruments to assess this in the financial decision-making realm that actually measured the person's actual decision. We have instruments that measure hypothetical decisions, and those have problems for somebody who might have some cognitive impairment, because Applebaum and Grisso, who are kind of originators of this informed decision-making underlying aspects and how that would tie into a kind of expert evaluations, they've shown in medical patients that people with cognitive impairment are much more likely to be able to make informed decisions about illnesses that they've had for a long time versus a new hypothetical vignette where they really can't remember the facts.
Mm-hmm.
And so my team and I, which was really my wife Susan McNeil and I, talked about this and said, you know, we really need to create a new scale or give it a try anyway.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, we were influenced, of course, by these decision-making factors, but we realize that decisions aren't made, it's not all cognitive, and there's a context to how people make decisions and how vulnerable they feel, either financial insecurity or psychological vulnerability around money or relationship insecurity around money. And we were fortunate to work with a panel of experts to help us create both a conceptual model and a new rating scale.
Wow. So we'll get to talk a little bit about these rating scales. Yeah, I think this is very helpful, these five elements here, the third one being the awareness of their deficits. I'm sure you see a lot of denial with people who think they're doing just fine and they don't have any problems. So that's got to come into the picture. And then,
yeah, a good way people can do this even at home is to sort of ask somebody, you know, do you think that over the last year your memory or thinking skills have gotten worse than they were before, and you get a sense. So I'll do a little bit more in-depth interview about how people perceive their own thinking skills. And then after I assess them, I take a look and compare the two. But I also ask someone, how do you think you did? And many times when people have done very poorly, they'll say, oh, I think I did just fine.
Masking the extent of their deficits, sure. And then how much influence are they subject to? Is this their own decision, or are there others coming that help influence that decision making? That's a good overview, Peter. I appreciate that. Looks like we're needing to take another short break here, if we could, and then we'll come back and talk more about the rating scales and take another look at the risk of exploitation. So it's time to take a short break, as I said. Please call in your questions to 866-472-5792 or send an email to info@living2100club. This is Joe Casciotti, and my guest is Dr. Peter Lichtenberg. You're listening to the Living 2100 Club on the Voice America Health and Wellness Channel. Stay tuned. We'll be back in a couple of minutes.
Opinions, options, answers. You're listening to Voice America Health and Wellness.
Visit the Living to 100 Club to experience the creative spirit, inspiration, and wellness information that you're looking for to maintain a healthy lifestyle, promote mental and physical fitness, and allow you to take control of your future. You'll find links to leading aging organizations and see our series of blogs. Get details about our weekly radio show and schedule of upcoming guests. Sign up to be a club member to receive newsletters and radio announcements and a copy of our member handbook, or opt for an annual premium membership with special access to our secure member forum and opportunities to ask the experts, plus transcripts of show recordings and other members-only offers. Visit the Living to 100 Club website for awareness, insights, and independence. Find us at livingto100.club. That's livingto100.club.
Sometimes it just seems that nobody understands. There's one individual who can help. If you're living with somebody who faces challenges such as autism, Asperger's, or other exceptional needs, you'll want to tune into Solutions and Strategies with Dr. Sean. Living the Challenge. Together, we'll uncover a variety of solutions to the challenges faced by individuals, their families, and teachers. Listen live every Thursday at 8 a.m. Pacific, 11 a.m. Eastern, on Voice America Health and Wellness.
Have you had a chance to check out Voice America's online magazine and blog? If you love our hosts and shows, check out articles that give an even deeper perspective plus topics about health and fitness, movie reviews, philosophy, business tips and tactics, spirituality, positive thought, current events, and even more about your favorite hosts. It's just a click away at blog.voiceamerica.com. That's blog.voiceamerica.com. The Voice America Press Blog. All access, all the time.
Your life, your health, your network. You're listening to Voice America Health and Wellness.
You are listening to the Living to 100 Club with Dr. Joe Casciani. To reach the program today, please call in to 1-866-472-5792. That's 1-866-472-5792. You may also send an email to info@livingto100.club. Now, back to this week's show.
Okay, we're back. Thanks to everyone again for staying with us. We're talking with Peter Lichtenberg about decision-making capacity. Peter, I'm curious about one area. We look at decisions for financial reasons, and then we have to look at another category of decisions for healthcare. Are there differences? Are there different capacities required for these two domains?
That's a great question, Joe, and there really are different contexts for these two domains. And making a medical decision really kind of conforms much more specifically to those elements we talked about informed decision making, and really nothing else. But in financial decision making, the issue of undue influence or coercion really has to be accounted for, because that can totally change the older adult in terms of they can parrot some things, but they really aren't making informed decisions.
So explain a little bit more about the medical decisions, where it's more based on being informed.
So really medical decision-making and kind of follows, can you communicate a choice about this? Do you want to have the surgery or not have it? Do you understand what it would be, why you would be having a surgery, why you would be getting a certain treatment? Do you appreciate the potential risks and or benefits? Mm-hmm. And can you reason around this? Can you tell why you do or don't want to have this surgery? And you have to have those elements for an informed consent to a medical procedure.
Okay.
Now, in financial decision making, you need those four elements also, but it occurs in a different kind of context. Usually in a medical decision making, what we're tying into are people's values and beliefs. And in financial decision making, we are tying into those, but we're also making sure that it's their autonomous decision. It's not somebody else has influence them. And what I mean by that, Joe, is it's really a process of brainwashing. Mm. And it's not a discrete event, undue influence. We're not going to observe it. It happens away from other people. But you can see the changes. All of a sudden, the older adult won't talk with their other children on the phone, or can't ever get the children will come over and knock on the door, but it's never opened. And we start to see the isolation, the poisoning of the relationship. Whereas in medical decision-making, you don't really have that kind of coercion, undue influence issue.
All right. So more weight is placed on one category for the medical and a different category for the financial. Yeah, that makes sense. Okay, so let me ask you about the rating scales that you've created, the Lichtenberg Financial Rating Scales. Tell us about that.
So we created this first one, the 56-item measure that measures not only the elements of informed decision-making, but also financial awareness, psychological vulnerability about money, and susceptibility to undue influence or exploitation. And partially we did that because we did some research on what what predicted fraud experience an older adult? We're all of us humans are vulnerable to being defrauded, and older adults are as well, but some are more vulnerable. And in a cognitively intact population, we found that psychological vulnerability made people two or three times more vulnerable to being a victim of fraud. So we wanted to make sure we got that context and that vulnerability in there, and not just about fraud, but also financial strain, financial confidence. And as I talked about, conflict with others about money and relationships that have gone sour because of financial issues. So we wanted to get all of that. And once we did that, we were funded by the Department of Justice then to validate the scale, but they encouraged us also to create other scales, and we did. Based on the first one, we created a 10-item screening scale, which could be used by anybody who was sitting with an older adult making a financial decision. And then we create a family and friends interview, which can get the perspective of hopefully an objective person about the older adult and their decision-making process. Mm-hmm. Once we did that, we were fortunate enough to get a different grant to create a website where we could train people online, narrated trainings for each of the scales, and also give them a place to either administer the scales or enter in the scores after they administered a PDF paper version, and then it would give them kind of a risk score feedback as well as suggested next steps. So we completed that. We completed the scale in 2013. We had our first validation publication in 2015. And in 2018, we really launched the website. It's quite user-friendly. It's free of charge to any professional that wants to use it. And by the end of the year, we will have a caregiver landing page as well, dealing with a whole different set of topics with finances. Mm-hmm. Mm. So we're very pleased with how this has grown from our scales to training and making them available. And we also are learning a lot because we created a program to offer financial coaching to older adults who are victims of scams or identity theft. And we do a lot of community education. What we find, Joe, is that no matter how we study it, financial exploitation doesn't occur in a vacuum. People who are exploited are more vulnerable across many domains, cognitive domains, health domains, mental health domains, functional social support domains, stress domains, and it really is that vulnerability that sort of makes them extra vulnerable, not only to losing a little bit, but to maybe losing a lot.
Mm, sure. Sure. Now, the screen, did you say, is available for family members, the screening tool?
The screening tool that we have on the site right now is for professionals as well. But by the end of the year, we'll have our family and friends questionnaire, which will be very similar to our screening, our informant scale, and that will be available to anybody.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Can you give people the website in case they just want to look?
Oh, thank you very much. Yes, olderadultnestegg.com. Olderadultnestegg.com.
Great.
Our hope is to protect that nest egg. That's why we named it that.
That's an important goal. That's an important goal. Yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah. So we mentioned earlier the delicate balance between autonomy and protection. There are plenty of cases that are in between where they're not completely independent and not completely dependent. So any advice on how to maintain that balance?
Well, I do. The first thing is you have to check on ageism because it's out there and it really impacts strongly how people see things. So there was a woman who had mild cognitive impairment. Her neurologist had diagnosed her with it. Her nephew decided he really wanted her money. So 2 months later, he came in, he made a story up to the neurologist about how his aunt could not shower anymore, how she was soiling herself all the time. They couldn't get her to change clothes. And the neurologist wrote a note saying she needs a guardian. Mm-hmm. She didn't need a guardian. She got an attorney. We did an assessment. She was one of the fortunate ones who escaped. And that's what I mean by promoting autonomy. Even though she had mild cognitive impairment, she sure didn't need a guardian, and she sure hadn't declined the way it was described to this neurologist. So it's so important to check ageism at the door. And I think the neurologist just believed it because she had something wrong with her. Of course, she's old, so there you go.
Yeah.
I think all of us have to check that.
Yeah, that's excellent. That's a very good point. What about identity theft? We're kind of running short of time here, but I'm curious, what is this a special category?
It is. It's less impacting in terms, unless people lose a lot of money and don't realize it, but it's growing. This is really an area that's growing, and older adults often don't check their bank accounts electronically, but they really need to learn how to keep an eye on whether anybody has gotten access to any of their bank accounts and is creating credit problems for them. And if they see those problems, of course, to call immediately to their banks. All of us are victims of identity theft. I think everybody that's ever worked at a university probably is. I know me and my colleagues, we all,
sure,
a couple years ago, dozens of us were victims of the tax ID theft, where we submitted our taxes and we were told they had already been submitted. And of course, you have to go through a long process there. It requires vigilance, and that's sometimes difficult for older adults to keep a close eye on the account.
Yeah. Well, that's good advice for everybody, but older adults may be not as observant or pay not as much attention as perhaps they should. Yeah. So, Peter, how can people contact you if they have questions?
And I sure invite them to contact me. They can call me, 313-664-2633. They can put a comment on olderadultnestegg.com, a query, I'll get it. They can email me directly at p.lichtenberg@wayne.edu.
Great. Thank you for sharing that. So in the remaining time, you know, on this show, we talk a lot about successful aging. I'm curious, how do you define successful aging?
You know, a lot of it is self-perception. I like some of the research that showed that, you know, when the successful aging came out by Rowe and Kahn, it was like an Olympic measure, all these strength and speed and cognitive abilities. But when you compared it to whether people felt like they were aging successfully, about 5 to 1, 5 times more likely for people to say, yeah, I'm aging successfully, even if they didn't meet these physical measures. I like that. I think self-perception has a lot to do with aging successfully.
Yeah, I like that too. The comparisons can be a trap too many times, so seeing how we do, how we manage, how we get over our hurdles. Yeah, I like that. Well, it looks like we're out of time for today. Thank you very much, Peter, for being with us.
Thank you, Joe.
Yeah, you're welcome. And thanks to all of our listeners for your support of our radio show. Please take a look at our website, sign up to be on our email list so you can receive announcements about our upcoming radio episodes and our weekly blogs. I'm your host, Joe Casciani, and you've been listening to the Living to 100 Club on the Voice America Network. See you next time.
So- Thank you for being part of the Living to 100 Club. We hope you'll join Dr. Joe Casciani again next Friday at 5 p.m. Eastern Time, 2 p.m. Pacific Time on the Voice America Health and Wellness Channel. Until next week, stay on the right track to mental and physical fitness.